Or
for me.
Waving. Okay.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, and we will be opening a public hearing on House Bill 5035. Mr. Buchholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Buchholz, Director of your Department of Revenue. Today will be about the income tax programs. We have our personal income tax administrator, Jan Martin, our business tax administrator, Jack Ogami, and we have our withholding section manager, John Galvin, and they're going to be here to talk about their programs, including that discussion about accounts receivable that I teed up at the beginning of the week. And so with that, I will get out of their way and let them lead the conversation.
Perfect.
Chair, I've been wondering if there aren't any equal opportunities for women working at the Department of Revenue, so it's nice to see a representation here.
It is. It is. Welcome. Please.
Are you ready?
Yep, you take the floor and run with it.
Okay, good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Ogami. I'm the Business Division Administrator at the Department of Revenue. This afternoon, Joanne, John, and I are going to provide a high-level overview of the programs and functions we administer in the income tax divisions at the department. Next. Can you cue our slides? We've got a little agenda prepared. So.
Oh, really? All right.
Joanne's going to begin by providing a sense of scale and importance of voluntary compliance and enforcement in our income tax programs. I'll follow Joanne and provide an explanation of our strategic planning process and related performance measures. John is going to provide background material to help explain the origins and reason for growth in our accounts receivable. And I'll conclude with an overview of our other agency accounts program. And we hope to have time left over at the end of the program for members to drill down a little bit deeper in areas that you might have special interest in. Feel free to stop us and ask questions during our presentation if that model works better for you. It's fine with us. So starting things off, Joanne, do you want to start by introducing yourself and telling us all about voluntary compliance and enforcement?
Sure. Thanks, Jack. Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Martin, and I am the administrator of the Personal Income Tax Division at Revenue. This afternoon, I will provide information about the magnitude of the dollars generated by the state's income tax programs. I will explain the importance of our voluntary compliance and finally provide some context for the various activities we perform while we do support the income tax system. Everything that we do at Revenue starts with our mission, and that is to make revenue systems work to fund services for the public. In support of the mission, our executive leadership team has identified several high-level goals, including our goal number 7, which is to enhance voluntary compliance and collection of taxes due under the law. The emphasis of our goal on voluntary compliance takes on a greater meaning when we look at my first slide, which compares the receipts of voluntary compliance to the enforcement function. This slide is depicting a fiscal year, but however, if you're looking in terms of a biennium, we bring in about $14 to $15 billion that we receive from taxpayers, and 97% of that approximately is brought in voluntarily. In terms of cost of funds received, in terms of cost of funds, voluntary payments or voluntary compliance costs us about 0.7 cents per dollar to generate. If we have to do enforcement, it costs us about 15 cents per dollar to generate that. The chart on my next slide is a visual depiction of the strategies that we use in working to push noncompliance taxpayers into a voluntary compliance status. At the base of the triangle, or the dark blue area, is the area that represents the bulk of people who file voluntarily. These are the 97% people and the ones that cost us the least amount to process their returns and so on. This is the state's core funding source, and we want to do activities that retain and grow people into this group. Halfway up the triangle, or the medium blue area, is the area that represents a smaller segment of taxpayers, and those are generally people who want to comply but for a variety of reasons may not. And this is where we try to deploy education and assistance tactics in order to help people to become a more voluntary and compliant taxpayer.
Senator Whitsitt has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. There seems to be quite a difference between the last slide and this slide. Is only 3% is collected through audits and collections, and yet you have depiction there of quite a lot larger allocate or cohort of people who aren't complying.
Right.
So could you give us some idea of an estimate, you think, of the amount of money that you're, the percentage of money that you may be collecting through audits and so forth as compared to the total amount that might be out there available?
And I think the previous slide where we showed the approximately that, well, the little wedge, which is a 3% on this slide, which is again about 188 million between all of our programs. That's not just like personal.
No, I understand that you're collecting, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I understand the 188 million is 3% of the total.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking what is the total amount that is might be out there that you might be able to collect if you had more auditing and more collection activity, because you know, compared to your pyramid, mm-hmm. That's a little tiny thing, and the top two tiers of your pyramid are make up about a third of it.
Sure. I don't know that I have a exact number on that, Jack.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, I might be able to help a little bit on this. A couple of biennials ago, the department prepared a tax compliance report where we had identified the tax gap as somewhere in the area of, was it 27%? 27 to 30%.
18%.
Oh, was it 18%? It was a significant amount, but one of the things that came up in that report was that a lot of that tax gap becomes increasingly difficult and expensive to harvest. It becomes very hard to obtain. Mm-hmm. So that tax gap exists out there, as Director Buchholz explained earlier, in a theoretical sense. How much of that is harvestable is mm-hmm. anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm. So if I might follow up then. Then if it's about an 18% tax gap and you're collecting about 3%, then you're getting about one out of $6 or whatever that might be available. And not saying that you could, but I mean, that's what's out there then. Thank you.
Thank you. And referring back to the chart, as I was saying, about the middle section of the chart does represent folks that are wishing to comply, and so we're trying to find ways to help them to be that compliant in our record or in our filing system. And then at the top of the triangle, or the light blue area, are the folks that are choosing not to comply, and those are the folks that we will use the full force of the law that we have in order to gain compliance from those folks. Let's see, I just lost my spot here. So at that point, that was my introduction as far as where we are looking at as far as our voluntary compliance efforts. And at this point, I was going to turn over to Jack, who will drill down and give a little bit more detail on our goals and strategies that we deploy.
Just really quick, Madam Co-Chair. Can we go back to the previous slide?
Absolutely.
Help me understand the second box from the from the top.
Sure.
Where it says people who don't want to comply. Mm-hmm. Help me just a little bit more understand. We deter noncompliance through detection.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that just a little bit more for me?
Sure. One of the, I think, enforcement strategies that we do try to deploy is, again, where we can identify people who aren't either fully complying, which might mean they may file a tax return, but they may not report completely everything they should. So what sources we have to identify, whether it's, you know, 1099 information that they didn't report, if we come across that information, then we would contact that person and ask them to correct their tax return, or we would correct it for them. So we try to use a variety of methods like that in order to find those folks that may be under-reporting.
That makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Yes.
Oh. Okay, so good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. In this section of our presentation, I'll provide a high-level overview of our tax compliance strategies. I plan to start very broadly and describe the strategic planning process we use in the income tax divisions, and narrow the focus as we work through the strategies and work towards the enforcement-related performance measures and targets. So the essence of any strategy is based upon the purpose of the organization, and at the Department of Revenue, our purpose for being is in our mission, which is to fund public services. So that's where we begin our strategic planning process, making sure that everybody involved understands that the highest level outcome that we can obtain is to optimize the long-term flow of tax receipts to fund public services. This slide depicts the actual strategic plan roadmap we use in the income tax divisions, and we share this with all the employees. Across the top, we have the two rows, the top two rows. They contain our mission, vision, values, and the high-level outcome areas. And these two rows are set by the agency's director and executive leadership team. The five light green columns supporting the outcome areas Those are all strategies, and the strategies are developed by the division leadership teams, which are comprised of Joanne, John, myself, and our program managers. In support of the strategies, our first-line managers and staff develop the initiatives and the tactics that will drive those strategies. So that sort of explains how this all fits together. So now I'm going to start to focus on the two leftmost columns, which are voluntary compliance and enforcement. So we have two strategies for voluntary compliance, and the first is to make it simple for people to file and pay, and the second is to assist taxpayers and tax practitioners with voluntary compliance. And so a few examples of specific tactics in this area. Our staff has set a goal of helping at least 30 businesses or attending at least 30 business outreach events a year to help new businesses understand their obligations to file and pay. And our actual for last year was we attended 50 of these, providing one call resolution, publicizing the location of our district and satellite offices, and also to fully utilize the online functions that will become available with our new computer system. So in the second column from the left, we have three enforcement strategies. And the first is to focus on the area of greatest risk. And this directs staff to identify enforcement activities and initiatives that focus resources in areas where tax avoidance is most likely. The second is to leverage data and systems for enforcement. So we have a great example where we've accomplished both of these strategies in an information sharing agreement that the Internal Revenue Service recently approved, where the Department of Revenue and the Oregon Employment Department will be able to jointly data mine Oregon tax, Oregon employment, and IRS information to identify misclassified employees and other types of tax avoidance. And this data sharing agreement is going to give us a rich source of leads now and into the future. The third strategy is to use tools and opportunities to enhance enforcement efforts. Recently, we used an audit tool known as ACL to data mine the state lands listing of unclaimed property, and we matched that against our listing of debtors, and we identified approximately $250,000 in unclaimed assets that we're currently in the process of making claims to.
Senator Johnson.
Forgive me for asking a question that I haven't very well thought out, but you're data mining DSL's information. There is a not insubstantial amount of dispute about some of those properties, and I'm trying to figure out how, when you're combing another agency's data, are you able to ensure data integrity?
Co-chair Senator Johnson, one of the things that we do is that they give us the public data that we're able to match against our information, and then it becomes a case-by-case
reconciliation.
Yeah, so we will work with state lands on a case-by-case basis to make claim to the assets that are listed. And I believe they must have process then if things are in dispute on their side.
Okay. I'm not sure that I still understand that. So you'd go back then and who would be the adjudicatory authority if there's a dispute? I presume DSL because it's their data.
Yes. Mr. Okay. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, that's correct.
Okay.
They're the custodians of those assets.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Next. So in the area of enforcement, we provide enforcement services to three primary segments of the population. The first being people who choose not to file returns, and we call that population non-filers. We have another segment of the population who file a return but choose to understate their tax obligation by understating receipts or overstating deductions and credits.
So really quick, you're able to identify who the non-filers are. Is that primarily because an employer has sent you information that is shared that they've earned income?
Co-chair, we get non-filer leads from a variety of sources. One of the richest sources that we get is the IRS information, where a person will file federally and use Oregon as an address, and they haven't filed an Oregon return.
I understand. Interesting. Okay.
So those people are the underreporters. Then, of course, we have the people who file a return, but they don't have the resources to pay. And so we'll talk a little bit more about them later in the accounts receivable. So our performance metric for non-filers measures how effective we were at acting upon all the potential non-filer leads we receive. We set our target performance for 100%. This goal is currently beyond reach with our manual processes and existing systems. However, we believe this goal is attainable with our new computer system. Next slide.
What, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Would you go back for just a second? Why such wide fluctuations? What that seems anomalous. What was behind that?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, that's actually we got a little anxious on the computer conversion, and we started to wind down the number of leads we were putting in the bucket in preparation for the computer conversion, and this area isn't going to be going until this fall. So I believe that's 2013. We started reducing the number of leads we were putting in the bucket for people to work. So we are artificially reducing the denominator of this of this measure. We were still producing. We were still doing filing enforcement on 5,000 to 6,000 accounts.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
In and of itself, though, that's rather revealing. I mean, if you were asking, if I understood you correctly, you were asking your folks that are policing up bad accounts to do less. And I didn't understand. I can tell by your expression. Help me. I'm having a bad day. Help me.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, our biggest source of leads comes from the Internal Revenue Service, and we receive that listing once a year. And that's too many leads to put into the system all at once. So we put it in quarterly. And so if we received X number of leads, we put in a fourth throughout each quarter of the year. I think in these two quarters, what had happened was that we didn't want to have, and we don't get to all of the leads. That's one of the things that this measure is telling us, is that more often than not, there's a good number of leads that we don't get to. So what we are planning on doing when we convert is going through the bucket and clearing out as many of those that we didn't get to, and not putting new ones in, but saving the new ones to add when we converted.
That just begs one other question. So if my last name starts with W and I'm close to the end of the list, am I safe? Or how do you pick the leads that look most interesting? When you said you didn't get to all of them, that's a certain level of subjectivity that we, you know, picked all the women. I don't know. What do you pick?
Jack, could I maybe answer that?
Okay.
Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, one of the things that we do that I can speak specifically on the personal income tax program is we do try to prioritize our leads. And that what we mean by prioritizing is looking at who may appear to owe the most. We want to go after the bigger dollars. That's where it's probably a better return on our investment of our staff's time. So we do have some way of being able to do some triaging in a sense of that, so it wouldn't be alphabetical or by what zone you live in or what county, that kind of thing, but trying to really get a handle on that. Maybe one of the other things I could add to on this specific measure, one of the things that is measuring is things that the accounts that we act on. We do get a number of leads that maybe are not, I don't want to say they're not worth pursuing, but for, again, our time and investment of our staff, it may not be the largest dollars to pursue. So we don't act on every lead we get. And this measure is looking at that, but we may have put that lead into the bucket and then determined it was not a lead for us to pursue. So that is some of the reason for some of the spikes. The other challenge with this particular measure for us is that it carries over from quarter to quarter. So if we did not get through all the leads in the prior quarter, those come into the next quarter. We'll add leads to it as well, and we may get them all worked or we may not. And that gives some of the ups and downs.
That's very helpful. I just wanted to make sure the W last names weren't escaping scrutiny.
No, they are not. I can assure you that.
Senator Whitson.
Yeah, the escapee. Thank you. What would be, I think, more helpful than the number of filers is the amount of money collected. Because you may have collected more down there at the 50 level at, you know, one in 13, in 113, 13, whatever. You might have collected more money there than you did at the top. And actually, the number of filers that you go after is probably not nearly as important as how effective you are in collecting it.
Correct.
Do you have anything like that, or could you make that available to us?
Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, one of the slides that we're going to get to in the accounts receivable presentation will show the realization rate on our
okay, thank
enforcement
you.
Efforts.
I'll wait for you.
Okay, so our performance metric for underreporters reflects the effectiveness of our suspense and audit functions, and we set our suspense business rules to optimize processing speed with return accuracy, and the target is to just at least 50% of the returns that suspend. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of variation in the chart depending on what period and what returns come in. Next slide. Similar to the suspense function, our performance metric for audits measures our effectiveness in selecting audits. Based upon historical performance averages, we set our target in this area at 85%. And at this point, I'm going to ask John to help explain the composition of our accounts receivable and the factors that influence the outstanding balance.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Galvin. I'm the Withholding and Payroll Tax Section Manager at the Department of Revenue. Earlier this biennium, I was charged with developing an accounts receivable management strategy for the agency. This has since turned into working with the governor's executive leadership team and the Institute for Modern Government to develop an enterprise strategy for management of accounts receivable. This afternoon, I would like to provide a high-level overview of the Department of Revenue's income tax accounts receivable.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
excuse me. Could we go back just a moment? Those last three performance measures, Mr. Chair, I'd have to wonder if we shouldn't, the committee shouldn't be looking more at the appropriateness of those measurements, mm-hmm. because in the first graph we have a variation of 100% from 50 to 110%. It's more than 100%. In the second, we have a variation from 30 to 60%. And the third one's no better. And I just have to wonder if we're measuring the right thing there.
Right.
That's all right. Thank you.
Yes, please, Representative.
Yes, thank you, Chair Smith. I support what you say, Senator Whitsitt. I think what's I'd like to add that what seems to make the most sense is to list both the number and the dollar amount. We want to be tracking, obviously, the value per transaction is what we want to see both at the same time, I think is the idea. And is this, so the percentage, what is the end number? Generally, when we have presentations, I think we want to see the end number. What is the, instead of percentages, what kind of number are we dealing with? How many cases?
Oh.
Yeah, what's the end?
Would it be possible for you to get that information to us? Let's stay on track now.
Okay,
you
sorry,
could
apologize.
No. Excellent question, excellent point. But if we could get you folks to gather that information, get it to John, and then we can get that dispersed out to the members.
Yes, co-chairs, we'll, and Representative Taylor, we'll get you that information, and we'll also supply some. These are composite measures, higher level measures. We actually have the measures that monitor the numerator and the denominator.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so this is the composite measure, the numerator error and the denominator error. So we'll get you that information.
So Representative, would you be okay if we got that information
Absolutely.
For the whole committee?
Yeah, of course.
Perfect. All right.
So this afternoon, I would like to provide a high-level overview of the Department of Revenue's income tax accounts receivable, starting with the composition of accounts receivable on page 12. This is a snapshot of the income tax accounts receivable at the end of fiscal year 2014. The withholding and personal income tax accounts receivable is approximately 86% of total accounts receivable, and the personal income tax and withholding revenue streams are approximately 87% of total general fund receipts. So this is showing that the accounts receivable is proportional to the revenue streams. The second slide here on page 12 identifies the debt type of the accounts receivable. This slide drills down one level and shows the source of the new personal income tax debt, both self-assessed and enforced. The self-assessed debt is the direct result of citizens filing their returns, and the enforced debt is the result of tax avoidance we've identified and acted on. The self-assessed debt.
So I want to make sure I understand. The self-assessed are the folks who filed their tax return but simply didn't pay what they owed.
Co-Chair Smith, that is correct.
And then the filing enforcement is folks who failed to file their tax return?
Yes.
And we're anticipating based upon our data, that they would owe us approximately $380 million.
Co-Chair Smith, the blue portion of the graph for the failure to file assessments is our largest portion of the accounts receivable, and it's debt specific to taxpayers that did not file a return. It's an estimate based on the best information available to the department.
And if I heard correctly earlier, a lot of that's coming from leads from the IRS. Okay. I wanted to make sure I understood.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Smith. So when you understand that you get the leads from the IRS, but you must be tracking from last year's information in addition. So are you using ACL to do the data mining for that? I mean, you would know from past behavior if you had a, you know, 5 and 10 year trend, if a person was always paying or not paying their taxes, and then you don't only need to use the IRS information for the lead. You have, you already have your leads.
Co-Chair Representative Taylor, that's actually one of the other measures that we follow. It's we refer to it as the recidivism
right.
measure, that once we do the filing enforcement on people, we expect them to come into the system and voluntarily file going forward. So we do have a measure. We do have a measure for that, and so we could provide that to you also.
Okay. Thank you.
So I just want to be, and then on deficiency, those are the ones who have filed, but we think that they have not filed correctly. Is that the third category?
Co-Chair Smith, the deficiency
help me understand
or,
that one.
the red portion of the graph is some type of adjustment made by the department. This can happen on both current or past tax years.
Okay.
And these type of adjustments are based on math errors, audits, or cases received from the IRS where they've made an adjustment on a federal return.
So is it possible to get an aging of this receivable to see who, of that 873, how much of that is new receivable? Now, I'm a commercial lender. Before I do a loan, I want to look at receivables and payables, and I want to see, you know, how current are those receivables and are they collecting on them? Is it possible to see what is owed in a current year versus 1 to 5 years, mm-hmm. or maybe 1 to 3 years, and then 3 out? Is that hard to get that type of information for the committee?
Mr. Co-Chair, no, it is not hard to get that type of information for the committee, and that is actually something that's come up during the statewide enterprise approach to accounts receivable.
Okay. If we could get that, just an aging of receivables, that'd be perfect. Representative Comp.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm kind of a big picture person, and the question is coming into my mind because of other committee work, but how do you communicate or work with our revenue office or our economists here at the legislature as we predict our forecasts for our revenue? Yeah, I know this is really far out there in the upper layers of the, you know, universe, but
yeah. Co-Chair Smith, Representative Comp, we have a research department where our economists in our research department work closely with the Legislative Revenue Office in preparing the forecast and supplying information to them about tax receipts and banking deposits and what sectors the money's coming from. So we have staff that work closely with Legislative Revenue to supply that information.
Okay.
Thank
you. Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
It's just looking at just this chart alone, it seems like it's when we're this close to looking at potentially of the kicker kicking, this just kind of makes me nervous. Looking at, just at this chart alone, what a difference if the numbers go one way or the other. It would make a difference in how we move forward in this session. So anyway, that's just where my brain went.
Perfect.
Senator Witz, it probably just is, he's going to telepathically say, don't worry about it, Betty, but.
Let's continue.
So collectability is substantially greater for the self-assessed debt and the deficiencies, in part because the taxpayers filed the return and they know they owe the money.
Mm-hmm.
They're typically trying to comply, but they either don't have enough to pay in full at the time the return is due, or they were unable to fill out their return correctly. our recovery rate for the green portion or the self-assessed debt is more than 80%. The deficiency debt recovery rate is about 65%, and the recovery rate for our filing enforcement is less than 20%. The third slide demonstrates our internal efforts to move accounts through our collection process to collect debt and ultimately reduce the accounts receivable. The green line represents debt that is typically resolved within 90 days. Collection actions at this stage are typically simple billings or taxpayer-initiated payment plans. Mm-hmm. The blue line represents debt that takes less than 6 months to get through our collection process, and this debt is typically resolved with telephone collections or garnishments. And the orange line represents debt that we resolve in less than a year. This includes all of the previously mentioned collection techniques, along with in-person visits, license suspension, property seizures, offsets, and partnering with our private collection firms.
Okay, so I'm gonna correct my earlier request on that aging. In my mind, I was thinking much longer term. As I look at this, collection activity is really moving quick.
Yes.
So if we as a committee could look at that aging in a more traditional approach where we see the 30, 60, 90, plus 190 and longer.
Absolutely.
That would be perfect.
So looking at the chart, we resolve 95% of our debt is resolved through our collection process in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the 5% we don't collect starts to add up over time, mm-hmm. especially in periods where we've chosen to focus on collecting current accounts rather than writing off uncollectible accounts.
I want to push pause here really quick, then I'll stay quiet and we'll let you folks move on. A thought just hit me. You folks are actually doing some pretty good work here. It's not as if you can pick your creditor as to who you're going to loan money to and then have an aging of receivable. You're stuck with what is.
Right.
And you have to go out and use the tools that statutorily are given to you to collect on this. And so the numbers you're sharing, we always want to see improvement. But this is pretty positive. Mm-hmm. Senator?
As I understand you correctly, you're collecting 95% of the tax liability that you know about.
Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, this represents liabilities moving out of our active collections. So it doesn't necessarily represent paid in full. This could be taxpayers that are on a payment plan or being collected by our private collection firms. But this slide is to represent our collection process moving after the debt is liquid and delinquent.
I don't quite understand how this slide correlates with the one before, or does it at all?
Well, it correlates simply with the fact that our collection process will help ultimately reduce the accounts receivable.
Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, maybe I can help a little bit.
Yeah.
The first slide was really to show the magnitude of accounts receivable we have outstanding. I think we have almost
right.
$900 million outstanding, and then the next slide talks about the resolution process. How long does it take for us to get these things through the pipeline?
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting about 95% of the accounts through the pipeline within 1 year and getting some type of resolution action on it. 5% of the accounts aren't making, we're not getting to resolution on 5% of the accounts.
And resolution does not necessarily mean collection, it means resolution.
Correct.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Continue.
We have been working with the state's Improving Government Steering Committee, made up of leadership from several state agencies, on an accounts receivable management project that will address identified problems associated with state agencies' accounts receivable. And the outcome of this work will include an accurate representation of outstanding debt and its collectability, updated policies and procedures with training for both accounting and collection staff, and an establishment of regular communications and oversight to address potentially broken collection process. If there aren't any questions, I will hand it back to Jack to discuss other agency accounts.
Okay. Next slide. In 1971, the state legislature created the Other Agency Accounts Program, also known as OAA, to provide advanced collection services to any state agency that chose to send their debts to OAA for collection. Currently, almost 200 governmental units, including other state agencies, courts, Oregon Health Sciences University, and a variety of boards and commissions benefit from the collection services of OAA. The $12 million biennial cost of operating OAA will be fully recovered from the over $100 million they're going to collect on behalf of our client agencies. And this last point, I need to clarify that OAA has not been converted. They're still using the old system and old processes. So in the last year, our OAA managers and staff have used business process reengineering to reduce abandoned calls and increase calls answered within the first minute by 15%. So the net impact of this is the first 2 months of this year, January and February, our net collections in OAA are up $1 million over the first 2 months of last year. And that's a direct result of process reengineering. So we're looking forward in OAA to the new technology that we're going to be getting in the fall of 2016. To better serve our clients. So this concludes the formal part of our presentation, and we'd be happy to talk about any other areas that you want to.
Yeah, I have a question. As a commercial lender, I can have a borrower sign a power of attorney within the Department of Revenue to get a copy of their tax return. There's a little box there, they check, they sign, I can submit it. Is there a reason why we couldn't allow lenders to have that form to where a borrower could sign off on that to allow a creditor to verify their owings to the state of Oregon? I can do it right now. I'm having my borrowers fill out power of attorneys on every credit. And there's two boxes on there. One is a complete power of attorney. The other is my ability to request a tax return. If I try to do it with the IRS, it takes weeks. If I do it with you folks, it's turned around immediately. Why couldn't the state of Oregon allow creditors to have a similar process to where if the borrower signs off on it, that creditor has the ability to call in and see what the owing is?
Co-chair, I would have to take
that. Is
that
too big of a policy discussion? Maybe, Jim, can we think about that? Let's not come up right now. Let's you and I think about that. It goes back to our conversation we keep having over and over. One of the things, I think you folks are doing fine work. I really want you to know that. One of the things that's on my mind, though, is like, it just bothers me that people owe the state of Oregon money and yet can go out and get themselves a brand new car. And so to me, I don't want the state to be put on the back burner. So Jim, let's have that conversation in the future. Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you. Comment. First, it bothers me, too, that we have people owing the state money and then we're raising taxes on people who do pay.
Excellent point.
The question goes back to a couple of questions. One, it goes back to slide 13, the $873 million. That calculates to about 5% or somewhere in the ballpark of 5% of the biennial tax load. So that is actually the $873 million is what is not collected per biennium, essentially. So what is the total amount in arrears?
Co-Chair, Senator Woods, I believe that is the total amount that's outstanding at any given point in time of bill. So we bill the taxpayer, and this is the amount of uncollected bill.
That is the total amount aggregated over the years?
As of
really?
June 30th. So that's one of the things that I think Joanne was trying to put into perspective, a scale. So $873 million is a lot of money. We're collecting
Mr. Agami, that would be about 5% of just the current biennial taxes due for individual income tax and corporate. I mean, in the ballpark of 5%.
Here's what I think. Let me suggest this. We have questions on these slides. You're trying to share a story with us. It's not clicking. Can you rework through this and help us better understand some of the questions that we're asking and perhaps tomorrow's committee, we could just take 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the beginning and try and rework through this. Would that be all right, Madam Representative?
Thank you, Chair Smith. And in addition, this says as of June 30th, 2014, but what is the start date? When is this time clock to get to the $873 million? When does that start, and when do you start, in essence, writing off and stop collecting, stop trying to collect? So is this over 10 years, 5 years? How long a period is this?
So let's try and get that information for tomorrow, because I think what, and I'm not trying to stifle conversation, but I think what's trying to occur is you're trying to show us the big picture. We want to dig down a little bit further, and so if you could go back and listen to our conversation and try and get answers to these questions and be prepared tomorrow to take 10 or 15 minutes to do that. John, is that going to be all right if we do that? All right. Let's do that.
I have one other unrelated question that has to do with the Willamette University collection identification and methods seminar that was held in 2013, and we've been following up on that. Has that been helpful to you? How much have you participated in that? And could you just give a little discussion about and whether you were prepared to do that now or tomorrow would be fine, but has it been helpful, and would it is it the position of the Department of Revenue that continuing forward with that conversation of how we collect from all the different agencies and the judicial branch and so forth, if that is helpful?
Co-Chair, Senator Witsit, we've been participating with the Institute of Modern Government, I think, since the origins, and we're active participants in their meetings. I think we're having ongoing conversations with them, and we believe they're doing good work.
Thank you.
I need to go testify.
I think if we get an opportunity to really see an aging of receivables, that'll really help clear up a lot of questions. All right. Any additional questions? Any additional comments? All right. How do you folks want to proceed? Are we done for? We're done. Holy smokes. That's pretty good. John, what do we need to be thinking about?
Co-chairs and members of the subcommittee, the agency has provided follow-up responses to your questions for Monday and Tuesday, and they've been posted to OLIS. And the Department of Administrative Services, the CFO's office, has a slide out there for Thursday, of their PowerPoint out there for Thursday. I just want to note that if you've already printed it, you'll need to reprint it, please.
All right, so colleagues, we're 40 minutes ahead of schedule. And so we can wrap up now, or this is an opportunity to have a discussion. You gals and guys make the decision. I'm from Eastern Oregon. We use the term gals. Ladies. Sorry. Fellas. What do you guys want to do?
I don't have any further questions until we get some answers to what we've already asked for, I think.
All right. So then we're going to wrap up. Is that all right? All right. Julie, we good? All right. We're going to wrap up for the day. And if you could go back and listen to the tape and try and synthesize what we're talking about and see if we could get some answers to those questions. All righty. We're going to adjourn for the day.